Assignment 3 is up on the website, if you want that. Remind you there's sample questions for the midterm and the final that are already up. I'll have the key up for the first assignment this evening. If anyone was not here last class to get their first assignment back, catch me at the break and we'll get that back to you. All right. So, end of last class, we just introduced issues of taste aversion, talking to my father, developed a taste aversion to kimchi. Now, one of the interesting things with taste aversion is for a long time, it was assumed that this wasn't actually a classical condition. And the reason for that was because of the seeming violation of contiguity. So you consume some food, typically, let's say, or drink some drink or whatnot, and then hours later, and in the case of rats, actually, it may even be 24 hours later, so after this very long time delay, you make the association, you get ill, and the association gets made. Now, we've talked about short delay, long delay, trace types of conditioning, and we said that all other things being equal, the short delay is the easiest and generally strongest way to produce classical conditioning. We get into problems, issues, when we have either long delay, where the CS is presented, continues for a long period of time, and then the US occurs at the end, or trace, where the CS is presented, the CS terminates, period of time passes, called the trace interval, and then the US is presented. In both of those cases, it's typically more difficult to actually set up the conditioning, make the association. And yet, there doesn't seem to be any problem having that occur in taste aversion. So, however we look at it, whether it's food poisoning, bacterial infection in the ear that produces illness, whatnot, something that's producing some form of nausea or whatnot, that becomes your US, and the nausea itself, the pain, that's your UR. Okay? These can come at a very long period of time, or after a very big delay, after you've had food or some flavor, whatever it is, okay, that's your CS, and we still get this strong conditional response of feelings of nausea, avoidance, whatnot. So this was kind of an oddity. For a long time, people assumed that taste aversion was a completely separate form of learning. It took rather a while for research to go, no, it's just sort of a special case of not having the slide advanced. Oh, here we go. A special case of classical conditioning where there's a very particular thing happening. There have been a variety of attempts over the years to try to make it work in a standard classical conditioning framework. For a while, it was suggested that there was sensitization involved. So having something novel sensitizes you. So having a novel food, your nervous system is all sensitized, and that's why the sort of trace delay period is kind of irrelevant. Your nervous system is so sensitized to the novelty of having whatever, macaroni and cheese for the very first time that you remember it 4 hours later when you start throwing up because of something else. Now, the problem with that, of course, is sensitization wears off really quickly, right? We're generally talking minutes. So that's a bad fit. Some research suggested aftertaste. So once you eat this new flavor, this distinctive flavor, you know, hours later, there's still a lingering taste of it in your mouth. This was disproven by, you know, doing things with, like, giving people, if you did this with people, you know, give them mouthwash, scrub their tongues, these sorts of things. You could do all kinds of things. You could do it just by scent as well. It doesn't even have to be something that's eaten. You can do this with rats. Very good olfactory abilities in rats. So present them with a novel smell paired with some say water or food they're drinking to make them ill. So there's no aftertaste. There's nothing left in their mouth where hours later it's like, I still taste whatever it is and now I'm sick. So those don't work. The best explanation and the current explanation, the one that's been accepted for about the last 40-odd years, 50 years, is that what we're dealing with here is a very particular form of biological preparedness. That is, organisms are predisposed to make certain connections between types of stimuli and physiological outcomes. And through evolutionary predispositions, I mean, think about this in terms we talked about the preparedness interpretation theory of classical conditioning. Something prepares you for an occurrence that's coming down the road that has survival benefits. So these have been selected for. The idea that you consume something and then feel nausea, that makes sense, right? Biologically, it makes sense. It's a predisposition there. Now, that's lovely. I mean, thought experiments are nice, but we have to show that. So a couple of researchers, Garcia and Kohling, demonstrated this quite elegantly in a series of experiments in the mid to late 1960s. I'm going to talk about the Garcia and Kohling 1966 paper. I think your textbook talks about a different paper. They published about three within, all on the same topic, slight variations in a year and a half. The general idea is exactly the same. Okay, so Garcia and Kohling worked with rats. Now, rats, I've mentioned this before, rats can't throw up. If they consume something and whatever they've eaten is poisonous or toxic, they're either going to survive or they will just die. Dogs, I mean, you know, if you got a pet dog, you've probably seen your dog eat something and then a little while later, blah, throw it back up, probably on top of your bed because they seem to like doing that. Horrible creatures, all right. But rats can't. They have no ability to regurgitate something that's potentially toxic to them. So rats are ideal for doing taste aversion studies. You don't have to make them very nauseous to produce a very strong conditioning. So here's what they did. They had two types of things that are going to serve as conditional stimuli. Flavored water, so they took some water and flavored it with anise. So it makes it taste like black licorice. Okay, so it's a licorice. They've got licorice water now. Okay, so that's the flavored water. Then they made what they called bright, noisy water. What the hell is that? What they did was they rigged it up such that, and for the rats, the water is dispensed in a little water bottle. They have to come and lick at a little metal spigot. So every time the rats would lick at the little metal spigot, this would activate a little mechanical clicker. So go click, 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 and activate a little electronic light. So a light would flash over top of the water bottle. So they've got this audiovisual stimuli. They drink some water, and there's a flashing light and a clicking noise. Bright, noisy water. Okay. The rats had never been exposed to either the anise flavor or the bright, noisy water. So they are what we call naive subjects. Two unconditional stimuli. First, X-ray. So they would expose the X-ray. If you have a high enough dose X-ray, this produces radiation poisoning, so nausea. You could use lithium chloride, whatnot. Garcia and Kohling happened to have, for whatever reason, just down the hallway in another researcher's office, there was a big X-ray machine. So they went, okay, we can use that. This was also the 60s when people were kind of worried about nuclear bombs going off, and so there was a lot of talk about radiation poisoning. So what the heck? They went with that. It's fine. The point is, exposing the rats to a high-dose X-ray produces nausea, makes them feel sick. Second U.S., foot shock, an electric shock delivered to the pads of the rat's feet. Okay? So, here's what happened. We got half the rats. Half the rats are going to get the X-ray unconditional stimulus, half are going to get the foot shock. So, we do a preconditioning baseline measure. Give the rats opportunities to drink from the anise-flavored water and the bright, noisy water. Statistically, no difference. It's the same. They show no preference for one over the other in either the X-ray group or the foot shock group. Okay? It's the same. Then, for the X-ray group, they let the rats drink these novel waters. Then they zip them down the hall. Boom. Expose them to the X-ray, rats get sick, let the rats recover. Next day, give them the choice, you know, let them drink the water again. And we find here that in this group here, after conditioning, after the single pairing between or exposure to the flavors, the audiovisual, so these two types of water, what do they avoid? Flavored water. They really reduce their consumption of the flavored water. They'll still drink the bright, noisy water, but they really reduce the drinking of the flavored water. Second group, the one that's going to get the foot shock, same deal. Preconditioning, test them out on this, see how much they drink, give them the foot shock, bring them back the next day, see what they do. Now, in this case here, they'll continue to drink the flavored water, but now they avoid the bright, noisy water. Interesting. We've got the same conditional stimuli, but we've got different outcomes. What's going on? Well, biological predispositions explain this. Think about it. This is like the old Sesame Street kind of song, you know. Which of these things goes together? Which of these things is kind of the same? All right, so we've got a flavor, and we've got an audiovisual stimulus, the bright, noisy. Now, we've got the X-ray. What does the X-ray do? It produces nausea. The radiation poisoning makes the rats feel nauseous, like they're going to throw up. They can't throw up, but they feel that way, okay? What in the real world, over evolutionary time, is going to make the rats feel like they have to throw up, even if they can't? Eating something that's poisonous. What goes with eating something? A flavor. When was the last time you ate something and lights flashed and you heard clicking noises? Right? Ah, that's a really interesting sound combination you've produced in dinner tonight. It's not biologically relevant. What goes together is a taste and nausea. How about in the other case, where we've got the foot shock? When was the last time you ate something or you tasted a flavor? It's like, oh, my feet and hands really hurt. Probably never. Unless you happen to live in a very weird household where people say, try this, and then whack you on the hand or something. It's strange. Same deal, it doesn't happen. But consider it from the point of view of a rat here, right? They're sitting there, and all of a sudden they hear something, you know, a rustling in the grass, or they see a flash of, I don't know, fur or a tawny color or something like that, and they get attacked by a cat. What precedes the physical pain? These audiovisual stimuli. Okay? If you get hit by a car, you don't say, yeah, I remember tasting cinnamon just before I was hit by the car. No, it's like I saw something blue and it was loud and then it hit me. What goes together? The audiovisual stimuli and the pain in the extremities. So there's a very strong biological predisposition here. This fits with an evolutionary interpretation. So the reason that we can violate contiguity, have these long time delays between the presentation of the CS and the onset of the U.S. is because there's a biological predisposition involved. Our various ancestors evolved. Those are ancestors that weren't able to make these connections between things they ate hours before, because the digestion process takes some time. So if they couldn't make those connections, they probably eventually just, more likely than not, died. Those of our ancestors that were able to make those associations, specifically with respect to things like flavor and nausea, we're more likely to avoid going back. It's like, I wonder if I should eat that purple spotted mushroom again. I got really sick the last time I did it, but that could be because of anything. Right? Next time you try it, you die. Yeah, I think I'm going to avoid that. Okay. So, what this is telling us is we need to know a little bit about the conditional stimulus, unconditional stimulus relationship here, before we can make some predictions about what your conditional response is going to be like, or whether or not you're even going to have a conditional response being produced. So this is kind of significant. Okay. Certain stimuli are just going to be easier to condition than others. This violates what Pavlov called the equipotentiality principle. Pavlov thought that if you have a CS that is easily associated with a US, that CS should be easily associated with any US. If you had a CS that was difficult to associate with a particular US, it should be difficult with all unconditional stimuli. That's not the case. Pavlov was wrong on that one. And things like Garcia and Kolling's work demonstrated that. Matter of fact, actually, they had a very hard time getting their work published because they're besides talking about taste aversion, they're also saying Pavlov's wrong about the fact that all stimuli should be, if you can condition it easily, it should always be easily. The fact here with their work, with the differences between the CSs and the US, shows that's not the case. And people said, I knew Pavlov, and Pavlov said that equipotentiality was correct. Garcia and Kolling, these young researchers, must be wrong. Nope, they were right. Pavlov was wrong. So even big names in a field can be incorrect. And that's the way science works. It works based upon disproof. Can you disprove something? I mean, there was lots of evidence that had been supporting Pavlov's interpretation. People just hadn't bothered looking at taste aversion or doing what Garcia and Kolling had done in their studies. Once that was done, it's like, okay, yeah, you know what? Equipotentiality doesn't work. That's just incorrect. Okay. So, some neat stuff there. All right. After this course is done, you can all head off to the pub or the bar and try to induce your own new taste aversion. Right? You should probably, to avoid that, practice beforehand. You know, each night line up, you know, half shots of or quarter shots of 10 different alcohols and take each one. Just, you don't want to get sick. Okay? You just want to prepare yourself, familiarize yourself with the flavor so that, you know, when you finally go out and really tie one on, you know, it'll be a flavor that's not novel. You'll have experience with it. Okay, let's talk a little bit about immune function here. Your immune system's kind of a nifty thing. We took a look at, we'll get back to that in a minute. Allergic reactions are actually part of your immune system functioning. And there's actually increasing evidence that suggests that allergic reactions are also involved in removal of pathogens from the body, things like this. Anyways, what happens if anyone have allergies? I mean, most people have some, but okay, fine. Release of histamines. So your body encounters something there, it encounters an allergen, and it dumps histamines, and this produces, oh yes, all the fun things like coughing and wheezing and stuffy noses and all the stuff people hate about allergies. But really, they're important. The runny nose, that's trying to clear. So the mucus is trying to flush your nose out. Allergens came in that way. We'll snot up your nose, make you blow it, and try to. Mucus is sticky and gooey, and you know, it's like, let's hope that catches all the little things that have come in and spurt them back out. Sneezing, same deal. You've got some allergens down into your respiratory tract. By sneezing, you try to expel them back out. So very annoying from, you know, our point of view, but actually it's your body's best attempt to deal with something that's gotten into it that is creating a problem. The interesting thing here is that not all allergic responses are due to biological allergens. Learning can come into play here. There can be a classically conditioned component. So, if you've got someone who's allergic to flowers, the pollen in flowers, right? They've had this pollen allergy for years. You know, walk up to them and wave a plastic rose at them. You know, a realistic, you know, an artificial flower, something that actually looks real. Wave it around them, and they may start getting the sniffles. It's not real. There is no pollen. I mean, unless they're allergic to plastic or something. Okay? That's a different thing. But, you know, assuming it's pollen, flower, chase them with a flower. No, I'm allergic. That's mean, isn't it? Yes, okay, fine. It's mean, but it's for science. Allergic response. Well, there's no pollen there. What do they see, though? Well, they're seeing the flowers. They see something that looks like a flower. They've had past experience. Oh, I'm sneezing. I can't breathe. What is it? What am I around? I'm around flowers. Matter of fact, this is how most people figure out what their allergies are. They make a connection. What caused that allergic reaction? I don't know. What were you doing? Oh, I don't know. I was around Starbucks. Okay, so you're allergic to, you know, corporate entities that practice bad business? No, I don't think so. Okay, were you drinking anything? Coffee. I had a coffee. Maybe you're allergic to coffee. Please, no. Right. Coffee allergies, okay. So then you do a test. You try different coffees, dark roast, light roast, you know, organic, free trade. You know, try these different things. Okay. You find what's there. So it's an association that can be made. I'm allergic to cats. Of course, explains why we have one. My wife's cat. Cat came with the wife. Just waiting for it to die. Unfortunately, I discovered that cats can live up to like 31 years. It's only 11. Median age is 17, so I'm going to have a rough time for a while. Anyways, I'm allergic to cats, have been for a very, very long time. Sometimes, if I go over to somebody's house, don't know them, sit there and maybe other people have had this experience as well, start getting a, after a few hours there, get a little sort of tickle in the throat or anything, oh great, I'm coming down or something. And then the cat walks in. Right? And it's like, oh, you have a cat? Yeah, we've got 4 of them. Didn't you know? Okay, I've been sitting here in this house for like several hours with multiple cats. This is impregnated with cat filth. Allergens, okay? And I'm getting sniffly. I'm getting a histamine response. It's not until I actually know there's cats there that it really kicks in. Right. The cat, one cat walking into the kitchen does not appreciatively increase the allergens floating around in this house at that moment. I mean, if I picked up the cat and rubbed it on my face, sure, you know, that would be a problem. Okay. Or conversely, if I know people have cats and I have to go to their house for some horrendous reason, you know, I may even start getting a bit of an allergic response before I even walk in the door. Okay, that's my body preparing me for this. Your allergic responses actually have a biological function. They're trying to remove the allergens from your body. So, preparedness. Yeah?
A friend of mine has a cat allergy.
Yes.
Over the course of probably about 4 or 5 years, one of my other friends has a cat, so whenever we go over to his place, we need to take antihistamine medication. However, he had moved out and gone to his own cat.
Your friend that's allergic to cats, guys? Well, okay.
Then
there's a different issue about intelligence here. So, all right. Please continue.
And he said that over the course of the several years that his allergic reactions to cats have slowly gone down.
Yes.
And he's had more interaction with cats.
Exactly, exactly. That's right. And in fact, this is my case as well. By being forced to endure my wife's cat named Beans, my allergic response to this cat has decreased. To other cats, it's decreased a little bit as well, but I can still have a worse response, particularly to the longer-haired breeds. Yes, and that's essentially what people will go and get allergy shots, right? If they got bad allergies, they may go and get allergy shots. And in fact, I mean, you'll stay on them forever, but one of the things that they're trying to do is they expose you to a higher dose of the allergy shot initially, and they reduce it, and what they're trying to do is build up an immunity in it. But it only takes in about 70% of people the immunity. Some people may never develop an immunity to the allergens there. But in some cases, like your friend's case or in my case, yeah, by being exposed to the cat daily, it does sort of the same thing that going in and paying lots of money to have an allergist specialist shoot this thing into your arm every few days and then week and maybe once every 2 weeks after 3 years. It has much the same effect. So, oh yeah, the first few years my wife and I were together and the cat was, my wife and I and the cat were together. Breathing was horrible. I was constantly plugged up. I'm better now. I mean, still some, but thank you for asking. It has gotten somewhat better. It doesn't really matter. You don't really want to know the state of my sinuses. We won't go into that. Let's just say my wife's cat has a few things to answer for. Here's a slightly more empirical study than this chap talking about his friend or me talking about my cat experiences and how materially awful they are. You get the sense I don't really love cats very much, don't you? Is that coming through? Yeah, okay. Anyways, something a little more empirical. Russell and colleagues. Anytime you see an et al., it doesn't mean Russell and a guy named Al. Et al.'s Latin for basically, and a whole bunch of other people. So it means Russell and some other researchers whose names I didn't feel like writing up here. Published a paper in 1984. Where they exposed guinea pigs to a chemical called BSA. This acts as an allergen. So BSA serves as an unconditional stimulus for histamine release. So expose the guinea pigs to BSA, develop allergies to it. And then what they did was they would pair the BSA up with either the odor of fish in some of the guinea pigs or the smell of sulfur in others. These would act as the conditional stimuli. Then what they would do, and you can measure with blood tests, you can measure the amount of histamine release that's being produced. So they now, after they've gone through a series of these CSUS conditioning phases, they now expose the guinea pigs to the odors. The guinea pigs that have been exposed to fish get that smell, the ones that have been exposed to sulfur get that smell. And they just take blood work and measure the amount of histamines, which is going to be the conditional response here, in the bloodstream. Now again, in this case here, it's a probe trial. They're not being given the BSA. They're just being given the CSs. Boom. You get an increase in the histamine release without even having the BSA. So again, it's the guinea pig's body's immune system way of preparing. It's like, oh, I smell fish. That means I'm about to get hit with a whole bunch of BSA. I better get ready for it. In the same way that, oh, I have the stimulus that says food's about to get stuck into my mouth. Maybe I should start salivating now to get ready for it. So in the sense, we have classical conditioning happening here in terms of immune function as well. Anyone think of some interesting applications for this in, say, medicine? Well, I'll let you think about that. But there's cool things you can do with this, and in fact, have been done. Where, say, for example, people that are going to go through chemotherapy, where their immune system is getting pretty much wiped out because all cell reproduction is being shut off, and actually, if you've got time in advance, you can prep people on this, cue them to things that are going to increase their body's immune response, and then during chemo, it's been tried to set this up to generate a stronger immune response, at least in the early stages of chemo. So the various things you can try with this. Here's another interesting one, a little more recent. Shaler and colleagues, 2010, showed human subjects, not guinea pigs, well, they're human guinea pigs, I guess you'd say, but showed people pictures of guns and pictures of people that have infectious diseases, right, that look really, kind of like Walking Dead zombie kind of. Okay, so people that have these infectious diseases. Now, they use a standard psychometric test to evaluate the stress that their subjects are experiencing, and they find that being shown pictures of guns, these are American subjects, is far more stressful than being shown pictures of people with infectious diseases. And, I mean, if you know anything about the United States, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Then what they did was they would draw blood. So they took some blood samples, and they incubated these with bacteria. So added, just add bacteria, stir, leave for 36 hours. basically they're seeing how much bacteria is going to grow in the blood sample from these different subjects. Subjects that saw the pictures of the infectious diseases, okay, that group of subjects, their white blood cells produced a 24% increase in cytokine interleukin 6. Don't worry about it. It's part of your immune response, okay? I mean, unless you want to worry about it, go look it up. You know, Google it or something, that's fine. But basically, this is a measure of how strong an immune response is being produced. The subjects that were shown the pictures of guns, even though their psychometric evaluation of stress was higher, their immune system wasn't all that concerned with it. Only a 7% increase over baseline, so from before they were shown any of the pictures. So what sort of cognitively stresses people out is a little bit different here from what's actually potentially dangerous to you. And you think about this from a certain perspective, over a long period, for most of human history, there haven't been guns. What there have been is people with infectious diseases, right? Leprosy, cholera, bubonic plague, typhoid. I mean, the list goes on. Bad stuff. What's likely, I mean, go back, you know, 2,000 years, what's likely to kill you? A gun? No, hasn't been invented. Or one of these diseases. Yeah, the disease. So that's what you get perhaps a little more, your body gets a little more worried about. It's like, uh-oh, someone with an infectious disease, even if it's just a photo, need to start boosting up that immune response. Now, that being said, with the American subjects here, living in America, and, you know, all the news about gun violence and murders and, you know, da-da-da-da, conditioning here, that's probably what's producing the stress. I don't know for certain, but I would hypothesize that Canadians would not show as much of a stress response to guns as the Americans do, just because we're not exposed to gun violence as much. We are, but not to the same degree. Yeah, but I think our immune response would be pretty much the same. So again, we've got conditioning going on here. We've got a learning process coming in. All right. Okay. Concluded our quick run through classical conditioning here and applications, things like that, real-world situations. We're going to shift into operant conditioning, operant learning. Now, I don't know why the textbook author did chapters 5, 6, 7 in the sequence he did them in. I don't even know why he separated the chapter 5, which is on reinforcement theory, from chapter 7, which is on punishment, because they're really stunningly integrated. So I kind of just thumb my nose at the textbook author, and I will be teaching you stuff from chapters 5 and 7 together. We will come back to chapter 6 afterwards, okay? I'm not necessarily doing this in exactly the same sequence you're going to find in the two chapters. That's fine. Overlap, but not necessarily in the same particular pattern here. All right. We call this operant learning. Operant learning, or also called instrumental learning. Synonymous terms here. There's three important components. There's a stimulus. So in the presence of a stimulus, subject makes a response, and this produces an outcome. So three elements involved here. The reason that we call it either operant or instrumental is operant, the subject operates, so in the presence of a stimulus, the subject operates on the environment, that is, it makes some response leading to the outcome. Or instrumental, in the presence of a stimulus, the subject, him or herself, is instrumental in producing that outcome. Something must be done. Some response must be made. Without that response, that outcome will not occur. Okay. Now, if we compare classical and operant learning, there are differences here. Classical, we've already talked about this. Reflex action, the US, you are. Somewhere, if you've got classical, somewhere in there, there has to be a reflex. Okay? Somewhere, there has to be a US, you are. If you don't have that, you don't have classical conditioning. Typically, in classical conditioning, we're going to take a neutral stimulus, although as we discussed, it may not be neutral, okay, but we're going to take something and we're going to take some stimulus here and we will associate it with the unconditional stimulus until eventually this stimulus comes to produce a conditional response. This is very much outside the subject's control. We discussed that. I mean, even if you know what's happening with classical conditioning, it can still work on you. Or if you don't know what's happening, if you don't know that you're being classically conditioned, it still works on you. Okay? So there's nothing that the subject really has to do. It's not like you're sitting there and it's like, okay, I'm going to ring a bell, stick food in your mouth. It's like, oh yeah, I got to remember to salivate when I hear that bell. No, you're just going to. Okay? So you don't have to make a salivatory response. And here's the other thing. You don't have to make a CR to get the US. Right? It's not like, oh yeah, when the bell rings, if I don't salivate beforehand, I don't get the food. It doesn't work that way. Right? Assuming you're doing an acquisition trial, the CS, let's just say it's going to be followed by the US. You don't have to make a CR to get the US. Okay. In operant conditioning, we have either the strengthening or weakening of, now, I put this in scare quotes, voluntary actions. If you go back in the literature, people used to talk about voluntary and involuntary actions all the time. Nowadays, I mean, this implies that the subjects are making a very active choice to respond or not. And that's not strictly true, but you can think about it. I mean, compared to classical conditioning, where it's really just happening at the base level of neuronal response here, pretty much, treat it as somewhat more voluntary. Your subject is going to respond or will not respond. And in this case, the presence or absence of the response, that's what determines whether or not the outcome will actually be delivered. So in the classical conditioning, it's not like, well, if you don't make that CR, you're not getting the US. But in operant conditioning, if you don't make that response, yeah, you may not get that outcome. Okay. I've got a pocket full of coins. If I don't put them into the vending machine and push the button, I'm not going to get my candy bar. Right? In classical conditioning, it would be more like, I see the vending machine, and someone comes and sticks the candy bar in my mouth. Little different, okay? All right. Now, they can occur together. Both classical and operant conditioning can happen in the same sort of learning experience. All right. So, goes back to this guy. The study, if the study of scientific study of classical conditioning goes back to Ivan Pavlov, the scientific study of operant conditioning goes back to Edward Thorndike. Now, this is a picture of Thorndike when he was much older, but he actually starts studying this when he's a teenager, when he's an undergraduate student. So he begins work on this as an undergrad, as part of his honors thesis. Thorndike had been, even before he entered university, been very interested in animal intelligence. Newspapers of the late 19th century were, and he's doing this sort of around about the same time that that Pavlov is working in Russia. They've never heard of either other anybody. Pavlov's work doesn't get published into English until 1907, and so no clue either one of them exists. Late 19th century, newspapers were filled with, you know, amazing animal stories about, you know, the brilliant horse or how the cow saves the family from fire, or, you know, all this kind of stuff. We still see this kind of stuff in modern media as well, right? You know, what's that? What's that, Lassie? Jimmy's fallen down the well? What's that? You pushed him there? Okay. Yeah. All right. So he's very interested in animal tales, and he's interested in, like, how smart are they really? I mean, newspapers write about all this stuff, but I mean, really, is that intelligence? Is it just innate responses? Is it just humans looking for something? This is what he's interested in. And as such, he's sort of one of the co-founders of comparative psychology, which is what we're talking about here. So the idea of using non-humans to understand human behavior. In fact, actually, he was originally interested in doing work with babies, with humans, human babies. But he couldn't get his project approved through ethics. Not quite sure why. But so, you know, even, you know, we criticize Watson for what he did with Albert, but, you know, so there were ethical concerns back then. So for various reasons, Thorndike can't work with human children at this point, although subsequently, once he gets his PhD and whatnot, he still works with non-human animals, but he gets very interested in really developmental learning processes. Anyways, so he... works with a variety of animal subjects here during his undergraduate and graduate work. Chickens, or young chickens, chicks, cats, and dogs. Tends to work with a single animal at a time, so one animal, doing a trial with one animal at a time here. And he starts out getting interested besides just the basic processes of learning. He gets interested in observational learning. We're going to talk about observational learning later on in the course after the midterm. So just kind of remember Thorndike and observational learning, because we're going to come back to this. Why was he working with things like chicks? You know, why wasn't he working with rats or pigeons or things like that? Late 19th century in most American cities, he's down in the U.S., chickens are easy to come by. I mean, every market. You didn't have Safeways or you know, superstores or things like that. You'd go down to the local market to get you wanted to have chicken. You'd go down and buy a chicken. Odds were it was probably alive. Lop its head off, pluck it, gut it, cook it, do all that. Food was a much more tactile, I guess, sort of thing, going back over 100 years. But anyways, you could buy young chickens as well. And in fact, he did. They were cheap. Okay, Thorndike was a student, much like students today, didn't have a lot of money. So he bought stuff that was cheap, like young chicks. He made his equipment out of whatever he had lying around or that he could salvage or find. Cats and dogs, a lot of strays running around. This was really before there was a lot of SPCA kind of things. Nobody was spaying and neutering pets back then, just not happening at all. So what do cats make? Lots of little baby cats. Okay? So there's no shortage of cats. Walk down an alley in any major U.S. city with a can of tuna, and you would have cats coming to find you. That's what he did, and that's how he got his subjects. All right. Now, we're going to talk principally about some of the work he did here with a contraption that looks sort of like this. This is kind of the idealized view of what he called a puzzle box. Puzzle boxes were wooden crates. And again, he made these himself. He found wooden packaging crates in the back alleys behind restaurants. This was back before there were things like plastics or cardboard, so ketchup bottles would be delivered to a restaurant in a wooden crate. So he'd scavenge, basically he was a dumpster diver. So he'd grab junk from the back alleys behind restaurants, drag them back, and you know, with some nails and some cord and a few like toggle latches, he'd construct these little cages that he called puzzle boxes. Now they're called puzzle boxes because the cage was large enough to fit, so for example, in the case of a cat, large enough to fit a cat. For the dog ones, they'd be bigger. You open the door, you put the cat in, and have any of you tried to stick a cat into a small container? Does anybody have the scars or the scars that go with this? Yeah, okay. Yeah, cats are funny things. cats like going into small spaces when they decide they want to go into small spaces. My wife likes cats. So back before we were married, I'm making breakfast in the house, look out the back window of my house, and say, hey, there's a cat coming up the back, you know, in the back backyard, walking up the path. You like cats, you can go see the cat while I finish making breakfast. And she goes, okay. And she runs out and finds the cat. And it's like she doesn't come back for a while. It's like, oh, great, what happened? Like, the cat killed her? I wouldn't be surprised. So the kid's out there and saying, it's a stray. It's starving. We have to. It's like, So we take this little cat in. Despite my being allergic, I'm suckers for little furry animals. So anyways, we feed it out. It's like, well, I don't have any cat food. What do I got? It's like, do you have any tuna? I don't have any tuna. What do you have? I've got this, you know, king crab in the fridge that I was, that'll be perfect, going to use for us for a nice romantic dinner. But okay, sure, let's go with the very expensive $12. Okay, stupid cat. So cats apparently love king crab, or at least this one did. Anyways, we can't seem to find an owner for this cat. And after a few more days, you know, my wife, well, not wife at the time, girlfriend, says, does the cat seem to be looking fat? And it's like, yeah, because like the salmon, the king crab, the yeah. It's like, no, not food fat, the other kind of fat. What are you talking about? I think she's pregnant. Oh. Sure enough, yes, before coming to us, the little, anyways, got herself knocked up, and so, yeah, so it's like, all right, fine. We're having kittens. Great. I'm not saying that. It's like, great, we're having kittens, because I can't breathe at this point from all my allergies. So, all right. Start out in zoology. It's like, right, animals need to have particular places to be able to birth for ideal, blah, blah, blah. But go online and actually research cat birthing. In the natural environment, cats will find small enclosed spaces like caves or hollows under tree roots to give birth to their young, so you can make a cat birthing chamber. And so, of course, I did this, right? Cardboard box, it looked, you know, make it sort of like cave-like. It's got a little porch that comes out on it. It's packed with soft, absorbent things. There's a little lip on the front so the kittens can't eventually get out. Mama cat has to carry them over the lip. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. I have to go teach in the morning. And it's like, where's the cat? No, it's like, I've got to go. Where's my briefcase? You know, you just don't get blood and placenta out of your briefcase after the cat gives birth in it. Beautiful birthing hut. My briefcase. Anyways. They love going into small things if they want. Trying to get the cat, we named Mercury, into a small carrier to take her to the vet to have her checked out afterwards. No, you'd crawl into the small case and bleed all through it. But will you go into the box to have you checked out to make sure you're going to be okay? No. Thorndike takes his cat, sticks him in the puzzle box. They don't really want to go into the puzzle box. So you can imagine the cats are not particularly happy about this. They engage in what we call in technical scientific terminology as having a freak out experience. So the cats are basically bouncing around off the walls. Now, you'll notice there's various things like latches, and strings, and cords, and a little pedal. So Thorndike rigged his boxes so the cat would have to do something, or sometimes more than one something, to open the door. So it might simply be you reach a paw out and flip this little toggle up, and the door would fall open. The cat could run out of the puzzle box and go get some fish that he had lying on a little plate. Or it might be that they have to flip the toggle and step on a pedal over there to open the pull the latch out so the door opens, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the idea of the puzzle box. There's a puzzle that has to be solved. Now, the thing with this is the cats are doing this through trial and error. Thorndike's not going, the toggle, push the toggle, right? He's just sitting there. He's just recording with a stopwatch how long it takes for the cat to get out. That's his measure. It's time until release. So the cat has no idea how to do this. So it has to utilize what Thorndike, he coined the term, he's called trial and error learning. So the cat freaks out. It's bouncing off the walls inside the puzzle box. It's clawing at things. And quite by accident, it flips the toggle. Door opens. It's gone. All right, let's eat the tuna, goes, catches the cat, stuffs it back into the cage, and here we go with trial two. And again, freaking out. Toggle gets flipped. Boom, out goes the cat. With repeated trials, an association comes to be formed. In the presence of the stimulus, which is the inside of the puzzle box, if I make this particular response, flip the toggle, then the outcome is the door opens and I can get to the bit of fish on a plate. So stimulus, response, outcome. And again, the cat has to figure this out for her or himself. Thorndike's not coaching the cat in any way. All right. Once the cat starts getting good at this, he then makes the puzzle box more elaborate. So flip the toggle. Now it doesn't do anything, so now you have to flip a toggle and step on a pedal. Then flip the toggle, step on a pedal, pull a string, flip the cob. He had something like 14 different variants on this puzzle box, and by the end of this, the cats are like, you know, basically doing stuff that would, you know, allow you to actually probably fly a rocket to the moon. Okay, maybe not quite that complicated, but I think the most he made them do was 3 or 4 different things. So he records. He records their performance. He's measuring what he calls escape latency. This is actually a scan of one of his original graphs that he published. How he published stuff back then, all by hand, right? No computers. He's just like drawing it out on a piece of paper with a ruler. This is what was published in a journal, okay? Stuff like this, you know? So for the fourth assignment, you'll have to do a little bit of graphing. I'll have that assignment up soon. People are going to come to me and say, can I use like Excel and just like have it plot all my things for me? It's like, yeah, you can. But frankly, if a pencil was good enough for Thorndike, I don't see how it's not good enough for you, because what theory have you discovered recently? Anyway. okay. It's just quicker to use a pencil and a piece of ruler and whatever. All right. So he does it. So here, look. The y-axis is escape latency. Okay? So, and then the x is going to be time, and it has to, and each point is a trial that's been conducted. So the first few trials, this cat is having, you know, it's taking it a while to get out of the box, sometimes a little sooner, sometimes a little longer, sooner. There's a lot of variability here, but after a bunch of trials at this, you know, you see it's actually pretty darn quick. You know, Thorndike sticks it in the box, the cat turns and goes at Thorndike, you know, I'm not happy, flips the toggle, out he walks. Okay. So trial and error learning. Now, out of this work, Thorndike formulates what he calls the law of effect, or Thorndike's law of effect. If you're going to discover something, you might as well name it after yourself. So, he said, when particular stimulus-response sequences are followed by pleasure, those responses tend to be, quote, stamped in, unquote. Responses followed by pain tend to be, quote, stamped out, unquote. What does he mean by stamped in, stamped out? Learned, making association, eliminating the association. So, learned. In both cases, they're learned, but in one case, stamped in means the response is going to increase. Stamped out means the response is going to decrease. Beautiful, colorful language back in the turn of the 20th century. Nowadays, instead of stamped in and stamped out, we'd say reinforced and punished. Something that is reinforced, all other things being equal, will increase in frequency. Or there'll be an increase in the behavior. If it's escape latency, you know, the cat will flip the toggle sooner. So actually the escape latency will go down, but the behavior has gotten stronger, okay? If something is punished, punishment reduces a behavior. And if you use punishment correctly, the behavior should probably just stop entirely, okay? So we'll come back to discussing the terminology a little bit later. But this is his law of effect. Things that lead to appetitive outcomes, a response that leads to an appetitive outcome, you're more likely to do that in the future. A response that leads to an aversive outcome, yeah, you're less likely to do that in the future. Learning. So, we talked a little bit about subjects here. Cats, dogs. He actually never used the chickens in the puzzle boxes. He ran chickens through mazes. He couldn't afford to build mazes, so he used his textbooks for mazes. So he'd stand all his textbooks up on end and make little mazes in his room for the young chickens. And he put some chicken feed down at the end, and he'd escape latency, record how long it would take the chickens to get through the maze. So, but cats and dogs. And regardless of whether you're using cats or dogs, we've got something that's very, very similar. Same basic kind of response pattern. The escape latency with experience through trial and error is reduced. They get better at escaping. We've talked about the puzzle boxes here a little bit, and as I said, he'd make them gradually more complicated. He'd try things. He'd move where the pedal was. He'd move it to different parts of the cage, see if that made any difference. Okay. Why did he use escape latency? Could have done it some other way, I suppose, but it was probably the simplest measure he could come up with that was easily quantifiable. So he's got a watch, and he can just measure the number of seconds. He doesn't have any video cameras. He can't actually film what the animals are specifically doing. The cats and dogs are moving quite rapidly with their paws trying to get out. He can't very easily describe exactly the paw movement or motion. So escape latency is a pretty good measure. How long does it take? And what would you count? I mean, you could say, why didn't you count, like, say, errors? It's like, okay, well, it's trial and error. I mean, what do you count as an error initially? The cat's paw came close to the lever. Is close, you know, less of an error than the cat scratched at the ceiling of the box? Is that more of an error? You get into judgments. So here, the escape latency is a very nice measure. Everyone can agree on it. It took this many seconds. All right. Somebody else can replicate that very precisely. And I showed you a picture of his time curves. Okay, so these look very much like these learning curves that we've seen before. Okay, so time curves. Here's some more of them, okay, from different animals. So like number 10 in box A, number 12 in A. So these are all from A. Now, take a look here. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, five cats here. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And huge amount of variation in performance. I mean, overall, they all show a similar kind of curve. They're getting better with repeated exposure. It's easier to do this. They get out sooner, but I mean, you know, this one's, you know, oh, really good. Blah, some problems here. You know, this one seems pretty darn good. Thump. Okay, so cat 11, pretty smart there. You know, cat number 3, hey, oh. Yeah. That was probably just a complete accident. It's like, oh, you know, flips the lever, falls out of the box. What happened? Oh. So, but notice what he does then. He averages. He produces an average of all the five cats he worked with in box A. Okay, so, I mean, averages, good things, right? You take the individual variation here, and by averaging the data, you get something that's more representative of cats in general. Cats is, because he's not specifically interested in cat 12 here, or, you know, cat 3 or whatnot. Right? He's interested in cats. Well, he's not even actually specifically interested in cats per se. He's more interested in the learning process that would be applicable to cats, dogs, humans, budgies, you name it. Okay, so by averaging, we sort of take out some of this individual variation here and get something that is perhaps more representative. Yeah, produces a theory out of this, this theory of law of effect. There's a few other components to his law of effect, besides having sort of a statement, the law of effect saying responses that are followed by an appetitive outcome increase in behavior, responses followed by an aversive outcome are going to decrease in behavior. He points out that this is an incremental learning process. It doesn't happen all at once. With each trial, there will be a bit more of an association being made. So in this sense, very similar to what Pavlov was coming up with for classical conditioning. And again, remember, they had never heard of one another at this point. They had no idea what the other person was doing. Other side of the world, didn't know. He discusses, Thorndike theorizes that what's really important here is the relationship, the association between the stimulus and the response. He thinks that is where the real association is formed. So in the presence of the stimulus, the inside of the puzzle box, you make this particular response. Now, as we'll see as we continue, it's actually a bit more complicated than this. It's not just an association between the stimulus and the response, but the outcome is very important here as well. But he doesn't see that at the time as being really what's important. Last thing is, he thinks that what's really significant is direct experience. He thinks that, at least for the non-human animals, they must learn by doing. They have to actually do the trial and error learning themselves. They must be in the puzzle box on their own. Now, how does he come back? He does some observational learning studies. So he's gone through, he's got some cats that are, and dogs, this is the dogs. I'm just talking about the cat data because textbooks all talk about the cat data. For some reason, they ignore the dog stuff. I don't know why. It's equally interesting, but everyone seems to talk about the cat work. Also, I've just done that too. But you get the same basic pattern with the dogs as well. So he's got a bunch of cats and dogs that are now very good at getting out of puzzle boxes. He calls them experienced animals. He then goes and gets some naive animals, some cats and dogs that have never been put in the puzzle boxes before. He puts an experienced animal into the puzzle box, and he has a naive animal in another box sitting nearby so that it can see what the experienced animal is doing. So our naive observer can watch the experienced animal, boop, flip the latch, and get out. Does this a number of times. Then he puts the naive subjects into the puzzle box, and he finds that they perform no better than the experienced animals did when they first tried this out. So he comes to the conclusion that watching another animal perform, so observing another animal perform the behavior to get out, has no benefit for learning. Now, why this is interesting is twofold. One, because he knows that humans use observational learning. Anyone that's around kids. Remember, he wanted to initially work with children. He wanted to do learning with children, but for various reasons had to work with chickens and cats and dogs. But he knows that children observationally learn. Anybody that's around kids knows that kids will imitate and copy and do stuff that older kids or grown-ups do. So he knows that. And the newspapers are filled with accounts of how animals do things that seem bizarre but could be explained by observational learning. So he's quite certain that they must be able to observationally learn, but his data doesn't support this. From what he did, it's like, I really thought this would work. It doesn't. I have lots of subjects I've tried this on. It seems that the only way that the non-humans can perform this task is through direct experience. They must do it themselves. Now, to Thorndike's credit, brilliant display of proper scientific method, he eventually recants this conclusion. He comes back and he revises things. Other people do additional studies with non-human animals in terms of observational learning. In fact, one of the things that was done was, instead of taking an experienced cat and having it demonstrate for a naive subject. He takes the naive subject, the observer, and lets it watch another naive cat go through the whole learning process, start to finish. So other researchers said, well, let's start with two naive cats. We'll have one be the observer and one be the learner, either the demonstrator, and we'll let the observer watch it go through the whole trial and error process. When you do that, you find that, in fact, yes, the observer cat, you now put it into the puzzle box, it does better. It has a reduced escape latency curve. Observing the other rat go through the whole, or not rat, the other cat go through the whole, you can do this with rats as well, the whole process, it does learn there. So it seems perhaps that there needs to be a chance to see failure, things that don't work as well. I mean, anecdotally, you've probably experienced this. It can be very difficult to learn from people that are very good at doing a task, right? Not everybody is a good teacher. You can have like some, you know, amazing baseball player. It's like, how do you hit home runs? Amazing baseball player. Oh, you just do this. Could you break that down for me a little bit? Yeah, you hit the ball like this. Still not quite. Oh, I'll show it to you again. So you hit the ball. That's it. Right? A good teacher is going to be like, okay, you need to grip the bat like this. You need to position your hips like this. Your feet should be at this angle to the plate. You're going to need to lean into it. They're going to take you through a step. And then they're going to give feedback. Okay? So if you just watch someone, right? Can you get better playing golf watching Tiger Woods? Maybe, but, you know, if you're watching Tiger Woods bounce a golf ball off his golf club, pink, a pink, a pink, a pink, a pink, it doesn't really tell you how to do that. It tells you that you can do it, but it's like, how do you start with that? So it seems that actually being able to observe failure along with success actually does lead to observational learning in non-humans. And in fact, when other researchers demonstrated this, as I'm saying, to Thorndike's credit here, he says, yeah, okay, I cannot argue with your data. You are right, I was wrong. Animals, non-human animals, can observationally learn. There just has to be certain particular circumstances in place. So he revised his earlier interpretations, as opposed to going, no, everyone else is wrong, I was right. That's bad science. So good scientist on this one here. So good scientific method. Okay. I showed you idealized picture of his puzzle box. These are some photos of some of his remaining actual puzzle. Well, I'm not sure if they're even in existence anymore, but we I think one or two of them may be still around someplace in a museum. But these are pictures of some of his actual puzzle boxes. And I mean, they look like crap that a hobo put together in the back alley, right? This is what he's doing. He's picking up trash. He's getting garbage. I mean, I can't quite tell what this is, but look, this box here, this crate, was a delivery box for some sort of product. I don't know, ketchup or bottles of vinegar or who knows what. I mean, he's finding garbage. I mean, look at this. I'm pretty sure if I gave my kid, my 7-year-old, a bunch of broken up pieces of wood and some nails, he could probably build this. And it's like, well, I don't have pieces of wood that are long enough. I'll just hammer a bunch of wood splinters in here. Really great. But it worked. That's sort of what's important. It worked. Laboratory equipment doesn't have to be beautiful. It needs to do the job. With science nowadays, we tend to forget this. It's like, you go back in time, and pretty much everyone who did experimental research built their own stuff, or were at least involved in building it. The psychology department here, down on the first floor, they've got an amazing shop. The psych wing here was built in 1960 through 66 to 67, I think, when the building went up. And they specifically built in this huge fabrication shop. I mean, most of what they do now is electronic stuff for data collection, but I mean, they've got lathes and drill presses and table saws and everything. This comes back from a time when people built their own equipment. Nowadays, you know, you go and you buy stuff from scientific supply houses, and if it doesn't exist, it's like, ooh, a lot of people say, oh, well, I guess I can't do that. It's like, no, you have to make it. Okay? There is nothing here that you guys, I mean, if I gave you a bunch of scrap wood and wire and strings and nails, you could do this. We're just so conditioned now by learning to expect that science takes place in bright, clean labs with shiny computers and blah, blah, blah. Excellent science, okay? You too can do science with basically no money. People forget this. Oh, you've got to have the $500,000 grant. And if you don't, you're not doing good science. Bullshit, excuse me. You can do brilliant science with practically no money. Give you $100 and let you loose in Home Depot. You can come up with amazing apparatus. Okay? I'd love to teach a course like that. Right? You know, 20 students, you know, I need a couple thousand dollars or a thing, and every student gets $100, go to Home Depot, you know, it'd be like Canada's best, you know, research student sort of thing, as opposed to worst handyman. Just buy some stuff, get some stuff, you know, get some sparrows or beetles or you know, whatever, a field mouse or something, and do science. So, anyways, so this is Thorndike. Thorndike was a cool guy. So those are some of his puzzle boxes there. So, and this is the other thing with these. He took these pictures because at the end of his thesis and the end of his papers he published in this, says, if anybody wants to try what I've done, if anyone wants to replicate my work, which is important in science, replication, he said, I will send you schematics and pictures of every one of my puzzle boxes. You can build the same thing and do exactly the same study and draw your own conclusions. Replicate this. So, I mean, that's why he was taking these were actually pictures that he took so that he could show these, you know, send these off to other people that wanted to replicate his work. So, this was the beginnings of the scientific study of operant learning. Also, the beginnings of the scientific study of observational learning with a slight setback. It didn't quite work out right there, but okay. Moving on a little bit in time. So from we're going to skip forward a little bit here to another big name in operant learning. This guy here, B.F. Skinner. Anyone know what the B stands for? Burrhus. It's like must have been hated by his parents. Yeah, I think we'll name him Burrhus. Oh yeah, that's not going to get him beaten up by the other kids in the neighborhood. Burrhus Frederick Skinner. So he preferred to go by B.F. B.F. Skinner. You ever see old photos of, like, you know, like 16th century photo or paintings of, like, nobles in Europe and whatnot with, like, a falcon on their wrist? I love this picture of Skinner because he's up there with his pigeon. So he's standing there. And he's standing in front of a bunch of stuff that he built. So this is all apparatus that Skinner built to collect data from his pigeons. Now, Skinner's interesting for a lot of reasons. He was a gadget freak, for one thing. So he invented stuff that is still basically and still used today. Updated a little bit, but all still used today for this. As a kid, he'd do things like make pneumatic catapults and like rocket beanbags, sandbags through the air. Occasionally put them through, you know, the neighbor's the windscreen of the car down the street, stuff like that. So love-hate relationship, I guess, with little B.F. Skinner in the neighborhood. But Skinner gets very interested in the operant response. So Thorndike is interested in just the trial and error. He's interested in the idea that animals will just, and humans, for that matter, will just learn accidentally. They'll try different things. And if a particular response, so if scratching the roof of the box does not get the cat out, right? So a response that is followed by an aversive outcome, I'm still stuck in the stupid box, will decrease. Toggle flips, it's out, that one increases. Okay, so remember, in the puzzle box, the cats and dogs are very accidentally stumbling upon what the correct thing is to do. And just if it accidentally they hit something that works, they're more likely to do it the next time. They may not. It may take them a while to come back to that one. They may not have got what it was they did, but eventually it comes around. Okay. Skinner becomes very interested in this whole issue of the operant response. He figures this is probably the most important, if you will, unit then of behavior in operant learning because of the effect it has on the environment. So it's a response that either produces the outcome, the appetitive outcome, or produces an aversive outcome that is not the outcome that might be desired. So he starts looking into this. Got a couple of little videos to show you here from his methodology.
While some scientists engineer shiny new consumer goods for an eager problem, Harvard psychologist B.F. Skinner seeks nothing less than the engineering of human nature.
This voiceover, this is actually something that was done back in, I think, the early 60s or so. So, I mean, the voiceover is, Skinner died in 1990, but this is basically, you know, being done contemporaneously with a lot of his work. Okay.
In experiments with subjects as simple as pigeons, Skinner declares that with the right social engineering, we can create a new breed of human beings. Skinner is firmly in the behaviorist tradition pioneered by John Watson in the 1920s. Like Watson, Skinner contends that with the right tools, we can predict and control behavior.
Skinner really inherited the mantle from Watson of behaviorism in this country. But it's kind of
this is a later piece that's been added in.
In the way they went about it. Watson, as we know, ended up becoming an advertising executive, ended up embracing the American value system as it existed. Skinner was different. Skinner was a visionary. Skinner felt that through behaviorism, he could influence the world towards a greater humanity, not meet humanity where it was, but take humanity to a new place through the principles of behaviorism.
Picking up where Watson left off, Skinner wants to do the rigorous science to prove that environment is everything. Change the environment, he argues, and you can change the individual. Or in Skinner's case, the pigeon.
Skinner himself was a born gadgeteer. He had, in his own early years, as a boy, for example, he developed ways of sorting ripe, I think it was cranberries, from unripe cranberries. He invented a cannon that would shoot things over his neighbor's fence. This was the kind of man he was. He was developing new ways to do everyday things in ways that were more comfortable, more efficient.
He was a nerd, okay.
During World War II, Skinner had developed a pigeon guidance device for the U.S. military. While the Russians had dogs carrying bombs, and the Swedes had seals to blow up mines, Skinner had a plan of his own. Teaching pigeons to guide missiles to an enemy target. At the time, however, the military had no missiles to guide. But Skinner's pigeon research did not go to waste. He develops a system called operant conditioning to prove that a behavior will be repeated by
it. Not strictly true. He didn't develop operant conditioning. If anything, Thorndike first studied it, but yada yada. Thorndike was dead by this time, so, you know, yay, Skinner.
By a subject, when rewarded, repetition leads to reinforcement. Reinforcement to changes in behavior.
This hungry pigeon is moving about more or less at random. Sometimes it turns its head to the left. When it does, we reinforce that movement by giving the pigeon access to a dish of grain.
Skinner then waits for it to turn further. Again, more food. Ultimately, the pigeon will turn in a complete circle, having learned that only when it turns will it be rewarded.
Now notice, this is different from Thorndike's trial and error. We're going to talk about that. I'll tell you about this in a few minutes, called shaping. But Skinner is producing a very specifically desired response. Okay. This is very different from what Thorndike was doing. But they're both operant conditioning.
What Skinner was able to do in very carefully controlled studies with animal models was they demonstrate that whole chains of behaviors could be built step by step so that literally you could teach a pigeon to do complicated behaviors that no one would have predicted possible.
Ed Skinner believes that if it works for pigeons, why not people? In Skinner's mind, behavior is made up and down the evolutionary scale, and it is all learned. One of the great successes is in education. People are taught to do more complicated tasks than anyone had thought possible. By breaking down behavior into small steps and giving positive reinforcement along the way.
The essence of Skinner's work was that we could manipulate the environment in ways that would permit us to produce any kind of behavior that we wished. We could develop individuals in ways that made every possible future open to them.
The idea that anything is possible.
Okay. So. Parks felt a little bit cheesy, but there you go. Just with respect to the educational, but it is a very interesting issue that so many of the sort of big names in psychology from at least the early periods either intentionally or unintentionally drifted into essentially what we call developmental or educational psychology. And then educational psychology sort of veered off from the main group of psychology and has now become a subdivision of education faculties in most universities. But earlier on, this was seen as, this was sort of, for many, including Thorndike and Alfred Binet and Skinner and Watson, understanding learning was seen as being so important because this could be then used to assist children with school. Contrary to the rather derogatory statements towards Watson there and being an advertising executive, that's a bit unfair to poor old Watson. But anyhow, this is an example of an operant chamber, which what he has not found. It worked like when I put this. Okay, that's annoying. Okay, well. I'll find that again. One of the fun things with copyright infringement is sometimes things don't stay up on the web more than a few days now. That worked when I put the material up. Okay, we'll come back to, will be other examples of operant chambers. Okay, now, all an operant chamber really is was the device that Skinner built for recording responses and providing outcomes. So an operant chamber typically has a stimulus, either a light or a buzzer, something to produce a simple stimulus. Response is going to be either, if it's something like a rat, and you've seen these before, we've shown animations, videos of these before, where like the mouse is pressing the lever, or a pigeon can peck at a little button. And then for the outcome, this could be a metal mesh floor to deliver a shock, that would be an aversive outcome, or little food dispensers for providing little snacks or treats to the subjects when they're hungry. So that's all an operant chamber actually is. All right. Now, there are different approaches to studying operant behavior here. And very broadly, they fall within two categorizations, discrete trial methods, what we call free operant methods. In discrete trial, you do one trial at a time, and then you have to usually set your apparatus back up. So think about Thorndike, okay? He gets his puzzle box ready, he puts some fish down on the floor, for the cat on a little plate. He catches the cat, he stuffs it in the box, he He records the time, the escape latency, until the cat gets out. Then he's got to stop, do it all over again. He's got to go catch the cat, put some more fish down on the plate, get the cat back into the box, do it over. So discrete trial. You can do one trial at a time before you have to reset or do something. In a maze, right? Even if you don't have to really, you know, it's like, okay, the animal gets to the end of the maze, you still have to pick it up, move it back down to the start. So with his thorax chicks, you know, blah, 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 they get through the maze, he's got to catch the chick at the end of the maze as it's eating some grain, pick it up, put it back to the start box. Okay? So there's a disruption in there. There's a discrete, that was a trial, now it's done, now we have to do something before we can go to the next trial. You say, isn't that kind of slow and tedious? And it's like, yeah, it can be. But it also lets you do a lot of specific things in terms of measuring, you know, how you measure the behavior. So in a maze study, you don't just have to record escape latency, how long it takes. I mean, Thorndike did. But it could be, okay, how many errors? How far down a wrong alleyway does the chick go before it turns back? How fast is it running in certain parts of the maze? So you can get a lot of very specific information about the form of the behavior. So latency, running speed, reductions, errors, all of these kinds of things. In the free operant conditioning, and this was what Skinner favored in his work, he designed it so it would automatically repeat. So if a light comes on in the presence of the light, if it's a pigeon that presses a key, it will get some food. A little bit of grain will be dispensed. Now, by automating this, remember when Skinner was first doing this back in the late 30s, 1940s, this was before computers. So he's not doing this with computer control. He's doing it all entirely mechanically. But it's just automated. He can walk away. Matter of fact, he often put pigeons into operant chambers, you know, late in the day, and he'd come back the next morning. And they would have run hundreds of trials overnight. Do them when they want. This is less disruptive for the subjects. They don't have to be grabbed, moved from one part of the apparatus to the other. The subjects can also kind of go at their own rate. If the pigeon says, you know what, I'm full right now, I'm taking a little break, or my tail feathers really itch, I'm going to peck at them right now, can do that. Okay. It's like, oh yeah, there's a light, I know, I'm missing an opportunity, but my butt really itches. Okay, I'm good to go now. Don't have the itchy butt, back to work. Whatever, that's fine. Okay. So this is less disruptive. What it typically means, though, is the most common measure, it's not the exclusive measure, but the most common measure of behavior in free operant situations is response rate. So the number of responses made in some period of time. Okay. You're not usually recording things like how the subject makes a response. Does it, if it's a rat, does it use its right paw, its left paw, both paws? Does it get up really close to the lever, far away? You're not usually detailing that. You're usually just using some measure of responding, how quickly, how many, something like that. So Skinner's operant chamber would be an example of a system for using the free operant technique. Now, one of the things that Skinner really stressed was that operant learning is a three-term contingency, or involves three-term contingency. Remember, we talked about contingencies. Okay, why, if and only if X, Y, I, F, F, X, or X, I, F, F, Y, however you want to say it. Okay. So just event Y will occur if and only if event X has occurred. So here's the three things that Skinner says are important here. You've got, we called it before the stimulus, but Skinner says, we should call it a discriminative stimulus. Because there could be lots of stimuli in an operant chamber. The operant chamber could be a stimulus in and of itself. But the real one that says, if the light turns on, press the lever, get some food, it's not just being in the operant chamber. That is a contextual stimulus, but it's not telling the subject when it should make a response. It's only that little light bulb that comes off. That's the discriminative stimulus. We abbreviate this typically with capital S, superscript D. Okay, so discriminative stimulus. To distinguish from other stimuli, contextual stimuli or anything else. There's the operant response. So in the presence of the discriminative stimulus, if and only if the subject makes the operant response, will there be the outcome? Now, the outcome may be appetitive or aversive. Maybe something that's, you know, to use the quote-unquote good or quote-unquote bad, so appetitive or aversive. Generally in psychology, at least in behavioral psychology, the behavioral sciences, we try to avoid the terminology of things that are good or bad because good or bad are kind of value-laden terms. What's good for one individual may not be good for another. Also in a rat, how do you actually evaluate whether something is, does the rat think of it as good or bad? So appetitive or aversive. Okay. So that's the three-term contingent. And Skinner would wander around muttering this. Three-term contingency. In the presence of the discriminative stimulus, if and only if you make the response, then there will be the outcome. So that's the three-term contingency. All right. Let's take a break at this point. So come on back in 10. If you weren't here last class, I have your first assignments, so you can come and grab those from up here. If I still need your second assignment, please bring it on up to me.